Welcome everyone to session 155 at Sunstone. It's, does the concept of Zion still energize Mormon hearts and minds today? And I will have to say, I'm completely gratified that it apparently does. We've got a good crowd here, and we're grateful for you all coming. I know in my own personal faith journey, there was that time when I first read Hugh Nibley's Approaching Zion, and there was that wonderful conference at Zion in the early 90s, and I was just freshly married, you know, 2 or 3 years, and I started to talk to my wife, you know, we need to go find an intentional community, and let's really put this Zion stuff to work. And so I've always been interested, and she of course said no, but I didn't sell it well either, probably. But I've always been interested in this thing. It obviously was a concept that animated early Mormonism, and then I think somehow we lost track of it there in the middle of the 20th century and stuff like that. We totally see a resurgence, and our question today is, how well is it percolating? Can there be reasons to, you know, to hope that we might be able to center on it again to a stronger direction? So I'm really thrilled to have the panelists they have. They're all wonderful friends and people that I admire. Boyd, I wanted Boyd to go first. Boyd Peterson here. Just quickly introduce Boyd. Many of you will know him as the biographer of Hugh Nibley. He is also the incoming editor of Dialogue. So starting in January, when Dialogue starts coming out, Boyd will be that person. He is the Mormon Studies Director at Utah Valley University. He's also written a book of essays that will be available over at Benchmark called Deadwood and Rushing Water. It's a really wonderful collection of personal essays. And he's just a great friend, and we're excited to have him talk and perhaps frame a little bit about that resurgence in Zion zealousness. Jim Smithenson is over here. Do I name the Jim has a PhD from Cornell in sociology, and he worked for over 25 years doing social science research and especially concentrating on international things. Are you going to share with for whom you worked? No?
No, you go ahead.
Oh. He did that for the LDS Church. And so ultimately his multiple sclerosis became a little bit too tough and he had to retire, but he's just been very actively involved in Sunstone. We became friends 4 or 5 years ago, and especially the conversation about consecration, stewardship, and all those things that permeate Zion stuff. He's going to bring up some tough and interesting questions about that today. So, is that good? Got you covered. All right. Rachel over here is wonderful. Rachel just was recently with me at a conference, and Jim, at a conference in Claremont, California called Seizing an Alternative and Looking Forward to an Ecological Civilization, a big one. Rachel just walks the talk. She community organizes there in Provo, and she was on a wonderful panel discussion we had on Mormon Matters about Mormonism and environmentalism. And Rachel has degrees. Let me quickly remind myself what they are. She's working on an MA at BYU in comparative studies. And what is it, literature or something for your?
Geology,
that's what it was. Yeah. She's got a geology degree from BYU. But I think you're just going to love to see her just, let's focus right here on the local community kind of stuff. I think it'll be a wonderful addition. Ron here, Ron Madsen, is an attorney, and if you haven't, you know, if you ever just put in Mormonism, peace, or Mormonism and economic justice, or what does the Book of Mormon have to say about justice and peace, it's Ron Madsen and his son Josh, and we have the unfortunate scheduling thing of he's competing against his son, who's over in a different session this hour, but Ron Madsen's a wonderful and important voice in really challenging us to look hard at our scriptures and to see what they really say versus all these layers and all the different things that pile up on top of it and obscure, I think, really important messages. And then we're grateful to have Warner Woodruff here. Woodruff here is just, you know, again, probably the key moments when Hugh Nibley's book came out, Approaching Zion. The next one was Warner's wonderful book called Working Toward Zion. And Warner really just is, again, one of these guys walking the talk. He's out there in the world, especially third world, setting up different projects and things that people can really thrive. So it's truly a working towards Zion thing. You've retired now from BYU?
I quit.
Okay. Well, maybe we'll hear about that, but Warren is just an important voice. So what we're going to do is everyone's going to take 12 minutes. I'm going to flash a card here, so there should be a good 20, 25 minutes for you to be part of this and share your what you see for the future of Zion in this. So, Boyd, you got your thing going?
No, but we'll start anyway.
Okay.
I've got a visual aid that may happen. If it doesn't, it'll be fine. So it's a pleasure to be here. I'm thrilled that there's people in this session. There's so many great sessions going on right now that it's really kind of, I thought we'd be speaking to each other. So I want to start from back at the beginning of the church. Belief that Christ's second coming was imminent accompanied revivalism, religious zeal of the second great awakening. During the 19th century, millennialism was at times almost synonymous with revivalism or evangelicism. However, the 19th century also saw a new breed of millennialism emerge and triumph in America, postmillennialism. As the name suggests, whereas premillennialists assumed that Christ would arrive on earth to usher in the millennium and then return thereafter for the final judgment, postmillennialists believe Christ would come only after the millennium. Postmillennialists tended to read scripture allegorically, seeing prophecies about the end times symbolically rather than literally. Prophecies, for example, of the lamb lying down with the lion represented not a literal event so much as a general move the world would take towards peace and justice. Whereas premillennialists believed the millennium could only be brought about through Christ, postmillennialists believe that human progress would inevitably lead to a future of peace and light. Premillennialists had modest goals about conversion, to bring as many as they could out of the darkness into Christianity. But after all, only a minority of humans were destined to be saved in the last days. Postmillennialists, on the other hand, believed that missionary work and social reforms would usher in the prophesied thousand years of peace. Postmillennialists believed, in essence, that if we build it, the city of God, he will come, Christ. Due to their more optimistic view of human nature, some postmillennialists label themselves optimillennialists, as contrast to the more cynical pessimillennialist cohorts. Now, Mormon eschatologically clearly linked the church with the premillennialists. Like them, early Mormons believed that the last days are imminent, that a voice of warning must be raised to call souls to repentance before the end times. The scripture's description of the earth's final destruction was interpreted in a strictly literal way. As Parley P. Pratt intoned, "The earth will be cleansed by fire from its wicked inhabitants, as it once was by water. And this burning will include priests as well as people. All but a few shall be burned." Nevertheless, a distinctive feature of Mormon millennialism mitigated against the despair over the earth's inevitable passing, and that is the concept of Zion. As Grant Underwood has called it, the pivotal preliminary event in Mormon eschatology. And he's described it as the final gathering of the Lord's elect in a most literal sense. It was a means for escape for the righteous from the anticipated tribulation of the last days. Zion was to be an actual at-one-ment of hearts, minds, and property that would secure God's elect if they persevered faithfully to the end. "If ye are not one, ye are not mine," the Lord says in the Doctrine and Covenants. And this at-one-ment not only required shared commitment and faith, but a radical redistribution of wealth. "For if ye are not equal in earthly things, ye cannot be equal in obtaining heavenly things." The word restoration, as used by early church leaders, did not so much denote the restoration of priesthood keys, rather it denoted a restoration of the earth to a primordial Eden and the restoration of humanity as a family with its God. Since then, two competing visions of the future have animated Mormon thought: Armageddon and Zion. These two eschatological visions of the future, the destruction of the earth and the gathering of a righteous people, continue to this day. However, the one is still interpreted very literally, the other more spiritually. The saints continue to anticipate the literal calamities of the last day, with Sunday school lessons regularly teaching about the signs of the times and church members interpreting global, political, social, and natural events through the lens of apocalypticism. However, the focus of Zion has shifted from the concept of a literal gathering to a spiritual gathering of converted souls. From a society with all things in common to a society of more or less common beliefs. The idea of Zion is still regarded as an at-one-ment of a people with their God, but it is a shadow of its former self. One of the few people in recent history to stress a literal conception of Zion was Hugh Nibley. Hugh called on us to live a law of consecration now, in this life, to sacrifice all we have for the building up of God's kingdom on earth, not necessarily the church, by the way. When asked what breakthrough he would like to see in his lifetime, Hugh replied, "The restoration of the law of consecration." He said, I'm only expressing a personal wish, he said, but that is what I was asked for. I would like to see it happen in the first place because I've covenanted to keep it. I would like to be able to do so. Even with that, I cannot avoid it, as we are told in the Doctrine and Covenants. Hugh was unhappy with the way Mormon culture was caught up in the mammon of the world. "More than enough is more than enough," Hugh said on numerous occasions. And he said, "Every step in the direction of increasing one's personal holdings is a step away from Zion." Today, the gulf between the haves and the have-nots has widened to an unprecedented proportion. And we hear mean-spirited political rhetoric decrying the so-called 47% who are evidently taking no responsibility for their livelihoods and who think they're entitled to government handouts. But Hugh saw things differently. Hugh argued that the cornerstone, what he called the cornerstone of virtue, "He that is idle shall not eat the bread of the laborer," which is held as the franchise of unbridled capitalism, is rather a rebuke to that system, which has allowed idlers to live in luxury and laborers in want throughout the whole course of history. "The whole emphasis in Holy Writ," Hugh continued, "is not whether one works or not, but what one works for. The laborer in Zion shall work for Zion. If they labor for money, they shall perish." Nibley often quoted Brigham Young, who said, "The course pursued by men of business in this world has a tendency to make a few rich and to sink the masses of the people in poverty and degradation. Too many of the elders of Israel take this course. The Latter-day Saints will never accomplish their mission until this inequality shall cease off the earth." He once remarked about a time when he was traveling with a general authority who told him that, quote, "The important thing is to observe the law of consecration spiritually." Hugh was flabbergasted. His response left the GA stunned. "Yes, indeed," say I, "and the law of tithing also. How much better to observe it spiritually than in a gross material way?" Now, soon after Mormons were forced to migrate to Utah, their leaders began to speculate as to why they had not been allowed to remain in Missouri and build Zion there. Brigham Young's response was that the saints had messed up the plan. "If the people neglect their duty, turn away from the holy commandments which God has given us, seek their own individual wealth, and neglect the interests of the kingdom of God, we may expect to be here quite a time, perhaps a period that will be far longer than we anticipate." Since that time, even as the Mormon dream of returning to Jackson County has dimmed, what we might call a Zion-seeking postmillennialism has creeped into Mormon theology. In a talk discussing the welfare program, Marion G. Romney linked it to the law of consecration and the Second Coming. He said, "From the very beginning, I felt that the welfare program would eventually move into the law of consecration and that this is the trial period. Until I can pay my tithing and make liberal contributions of my money and labor, I will not be prepared to go into the United Order, which will require me to consecrate everything I have and therefore give all my surplus for the benefit of the kingdom. I think the United Order will be the last principle of the gospel we learn to live, and that so doing will bring in the millennium." President Kimball linked the Second Coming to both our missionary work and the need for consecrated hearts. "Unfortunately," he said, "we live in a world that largely rejects the values of Zion. Babylon has not and never will comprehend Zion. The Lord revealed our times to the prophet Mormon, who recorded this statement in a closing chapter of the Book of Mormon. 'Behold, I speak unto you as if ye were present, but ye are not. But Jesus Christ has shown you unto me, and I know your doing. For behold, ye do love money and your substance and your fine apparel and the adorning of your churches more than ye love the poor and the needy, the sick and the afflicted.' This state of affairs, Kimball continued, stands in marked contrast to the Zion the Lord seeks to establish through his covenant people. Zion can be built up only among those who are pure in heart, not a people torn by covetousness and greed, but a pure and senseless people. And he continues, let us unite and pray with the energy of heart that we may be sealed by this bond of charity, that we may build up this latter-day Zion, that the kingdom of God may go forth, so that the kingdom of heaven may come. While the institutional church seems further from the goal of consecrated living, I've talked with numerous Mormons who found Nibley's words personally and spiritually satisfying. These people have given up high-powered jobs in some cases to pursue lives of simplicity and consecration. Even though we cannot fully achieve Zion independently and individually, because it takes a community of believers to achieve Zion, we can change our individual lives and refocus and retool them to focus on the things that matter most. I believe Zion does animate the hearts of Latter-day Saints, and I've witnessed the amazing lives consecration has produced. Thank you.
Do you want to do it? Do you want to describe what you're going to show?
Yeah, I can tell you really quick. BYU has a wonderful database called the Corpus, and you can search and see the number of times a word is mentioned in conference reports. If you're interested, it's corpus.byu.edu/GC, like General Conference. And so I put in the word Zion, and it's quite interesting to look at. The word steadily rises until 1900s, and then it pretty much bottoms out, and it stayed very low in just being mentioned in General Conference. So,
and it hasn't started?
No. So in that sense, we've got a long ways to go.
Well, thank you. Is this the best way just to bring it over to you, John?
I guess so.
Christians will be talking about when it's going to happen and how it's going to happen. The Mormon contribution to that discussion of this principle of consecration and stewardship. So for my bit, I want to give a very simple historical setup for that concept, including a couple of reasons that it might have fallen off the radar. People, I've heard the word nuance used quite a bit in these sessions. My overview is not going to be nuanced. It's going to be probably a little heavy-handed, but I'm trying to make a point. And I want to talk a little bit about the process, the prospects going forward. The 19th century, I think, consecration and stewardship, which I'll call CNS just for brevity, offered an alternative to runaway individualism. It did it within the prevailing agrarian craft economy. And for the most part, it wasn't successful as a community economy, as a community experiment. But there were a number of successes, nevertheless, because of the principles, building temples, helping people immigrate from Europe, organizing the migration to Utah. And one of my favorite, Wallace Stegner, the great observer of the American West, who was very critical of the homestead settlement of the West and the emphasis on individualism and independence, was always a big fan of the Mormon villages, where people cooperate on irrigation projects, built their fields around the village and the grazing was done outside of that. And so it was a community-based alternative. But in some ways for me, the 19th century consecration and stewardship has become kind of a lovely artifact to be admired. It's something we take down from the display case every once in a while and look at it, but that's all it is. In the 20th century, I think CNS had the potential to offer an alternative to market versus command economies within an industrial system. The late Gordon Wagner's dissertation in economics at Cornell, he argued that CNS constituted a legitimate third way, that it included both the just distribution of a socialist system and the freedom and initiative of a private property system. And combining that with some concepts on more modern concepts on self-management, he argued that it was a viable alternative to the direction things were going. But I think during that period, the fear of communism, which was just absolutely pervasive all through Mormonism, really doomed any consideration of alternatives. The church bought, and church members pretty much bought fully into capitalism, with the accompanying inequality, exploitation, and endless growth. And the welfare program endured as a minor kind of corrective, but it didn't challenge it. So in the 20th century, my sort of blunt view of history is that consecration and stewardship sort of became a fatality of the Cold War. So that brings us to the 21st century and a whole set of new conditions. And I want to describe those very quickly. Let me give you three examples. One, a Methodist bishop from Mozambique at the UN Council said, African children die so that American children may overeat. I don't think he's trying to just be overdramatic. I think he's trying to describe a global system that benefits a few at the expense of many in ways that we often don't see. Example two, I buy cute t-shirts for my kids, my grandkids, at a national chain store. I get inexpensive clothing. Other people get, the people who worked or who did these, get dangerous work, low pay, and a toxic environment. Our world gets resource depletion, pollution, growing inequality. But hey, I got a cute t-shirt out of the deal. Example three. If Christ were to retell the parable of the Good Samaritan, the victim on the side of the road could still be someone who's mugged, but it might also be a young woman who's working in a factory just across the border in Mexico and living in terribly unsafe conditions and perhaps being assaulted or worse and needing help. It could have to do with the child who, in China or India, who spends his days scrounging scrap electronic parts off a junkyard to reclaim valuable metals, but in so doing works in a toxic environment and ruins his health. All of these are examples of what people, observers, have called structural evil. It is not personal evil. It's often not visible without some very deliberate effort, but we participate in it by being part of a global system. And it has terrible consequences for people: poverty, misery, and death. It's an integral part of the world we live in today. It's one of the defining characteristics. That's always been a part of our world. I mean, think of slavery and colonialism, but it's pervasive now. And I think that it poses a new challenge for consecration and stewardship. To be relevant, I think today, CNS has to offer alternatives to that world that we live in. And CNS cannot do that unless it recognizes that those structural evils are part of our world and need to be part of the discussion. Three suggestions. One, we need to learn to see the global system and to see our role in it, to see the impact that our lifestyle has on others, even though we often take it for granted, the impact of our ideology, such as limitless growth, has on other people. Second, we need to learn to see past privatized morality. In the church, we tend to make a big deal about being personally pure in heart, as White said. But we often forget that the person who carries the temple recommend is just as complicit in this world system as the person who does not. As the church right now worries about the saving the family, and we worry about gay people destroying the family, I think that one bigger threat's come from things like immigration, where families are torn apart and live in different parts of the world because of the conditions that they face. And number three, we need to revive the discussion of consecration and stewardship. We can't anticipate what it will look like in our days, but we have the principles in place. Boyd read some of them. We're commanded to be one. We're told that if we're not one, we can't be gods. God says and possessive. We're told that it's not right that one person should hold that which is above another. We know the principles. We're all children of God. The earth is God's. Therefore, the earth belongs to all of his children. But we must add, I think, a recognition of the current reality. My question, can consecration and stewardship become... Can we discuss consecration and stewardship in a more positive way now? Can we talk about, for example, repurposing all of the global connections we have so that people around the world can really live together in love? I know that's utopian, and I know it's far-fetched, but I also believe that it's fair to ask if the restoration really does have anything to offer a needy and desperate world. I love Boyd's introduction that in the early days, the notion of restoration was a restoration of the earth, of everything to a state it should be in. As Dominic Croson talked about last night, a world of justice. I hope that we can revive the discussion of the role of consecration and our principles from the restoration in that process. Thank you.
Blinded by the blue light there, people. All right. So Zion is a concept that I've loved for a long time. I can
She's
remember...
open.
Closer. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So I can remember being in seminary and going through and finding all the scriptures that were Zion and one heart and one mind and cross-referencing them and putting them too with Christ being like the hen gathering in her chicks, and they're all marked in blue in my scripture. It's a very calm color. But I love this idea that Zion will be of one heart and one mind and there will be no poor among us. But Christ told us that the poor you will always have with you, but you won't always have with me. So it seems to me it's going to be hard to create that situation where there are no poor among us if we're always going to have them with us. But I still love the idea. I'm someone who's drawn to poetry and these ideals and to pragmatic hard work. They work together in my life. So, my neighborhood that I live in downtown Provo, is fantastic. When we moved in, I was moving in by myself, my husband was still in New York, and I was there with the kids. Before we'd even signed on the house, this old guy rides up on his bicycle, and he's like, I live just one block down, I've got tools, we can help you with anything you need, because this is an old house, and it is an old house, it's 1904, and trust me, I mean, I'm happy with the decision, but there's a lot of work involved in that. And he is typical of the people in our neighborhood. In fact, anytime I want to see Dean, I can just put out a little pile of branches by the side of my yard, and he'll come up in his old Chevy truck, which is a couple of decades older than I am, and it's like, can I take those for you? But he kind of patrols the neighborhood looking for things that he can do to help others. So this is the neighborhood that we moved into, and in this neighborhood, our ward was about 4 blocks by 3 blocks. So this little square of 12 blocks in downtown Provo. And it's a pretty poor area. We have Title I school. 2/3 of the kids in our school don't speak English as their native language at home. And we have a lot of college students, married college students in the area, so very transient. There aren't that many families with kids, so our youth program is very, very tiny. But in this ward, we have a couple of college professors, we have a lot of blue-collar workers, and we have a lot of students. So there's a woman, Shirley Lefevre. Her husband died. Now, the house that they were living in was one that he had constructed, I think mostly with spit and duct tape. You know, it's kind of a shack. It might be generous to have called it a shack, and that's where they lived. And he was a very controlling man, not the nicest person. And so when he died, she was alone in this shack that had been built. And she's an adorable little old woman in her late 70s. And so we got together as a neighborhood. We put in money, and we weren't doing this as an award because this is private charity here, but it was the ward that was organizing it. And we reinforced her walls. We gave her insulation in the attic and the walls. We put a roof on this shack. When she dies, this thing will be condemned and torn down. But in the meantime, she has a place to live. And we were all there working together. That's what Zion is to me. That we all are working in the place to care for each other. This is a kind of cooperative community that is a type of Zion that we can realize. And we see this in our neighborhood too, with our 4th of July parties, with Halloween. Halloween is the best because everyone opens their doors to you, everyone's out walking in the street. It's a great spirit. It's a little bit like Wendell Berry's Port William Township, where we are people bound together by this little bit of land where we live, and we are, to use Wallace Stegner's term, the stickers. We're the ones who stay and build up a place. But there's a danger to this kind of Zion, and that is that you build up a too inwardly turned community. So people who are not Mormon, never have been, people who are lapsed Mormons and don't really want to be anymore, and I count several of my neighbors who are in this category as my friends, have a very difficult time fitting into the social fabric of the neighborhood. Or they have to do it quietly, like my neighbors just to the south of me, who are a fantastic gay couple who've been together for 15 years, able to be there, but quiet, right? So even in this neighborhood where we have lots of Spanish-speaking people, because we don't go to church with them, because they go to the Spanish ward, we don't know them as our brothers and sisters in the church, and we're divided from them, and you can assume that any Mexican you see probably isn't Mormon. And that's not good for race relations in Provo, let me tell you. We forget that the people we don't see at church on Sunday are just as saintly as we are or as we hope to become. So this kind of Zionic insularity is dangerous. It's exclusionary. And a poet that I really like, Robinson Jeffers, who had this philosophy of inhumanism, this idea that we can't only focus on the human, we need to expand our notion of what the world is and what our connections is to all of creation, talked about this inward focus. And he would exaggerate this and use incest as the real idea of man turned too inward. So his inhumanist hero is Orestes in his version of the Oresteia, the Tower Beyond Tragedy. And this Orestes is able to escape that inward focus and incestuous temptation by falling in love outward. So I'm going to read just a little bit of this poem from Orestes' vision. All people strained at each other in the darkness. All loved or fought inward. Each one of the lost people sought the eyes of another, that another should praise him, sought never his own but another's. It is all turned inward, all your desires incestuous. The woman, the serpent, the man, the rose-red cavern, both human, worship forever. So Orestes, the mother slayer, is the resolution between man and nature. Back to the poem. I was the darkness outside the stars. I included them. They were a part of me. I was mankind also, a moving lichen on the cheek of the round stone. I and my loved are one, no desire but fulfilled, no passion but peace. The pure flame and the white fire than any passion, no time but spiral eternity. What fills men's mouths is nothing, and your threat is nothing. I have fallen in love outward. So how do we fall in love outward if we're trying to build a Zion-like community within our wards? And the church actually gives us a little bit of help with this. So 3 years ago, I experienced one of the most traumatic things in my entire church going existence, and that was a ward boundary change. I've never been in a place where this happened before. I'm from Texas. The same people go to church in that ward now as did when I grew up, and every woman at church speaks with a southern accent because that's what you do. And then in our little branch in New York, we were tiny and struggling, but there weren't any changes in the foreseeable future. So yeah, moved to Provo, and it turns out this happens every couple of years, that they'll change the boundaries and the state boundaries, and my God, that was the worst thing that had happened to me. So we're at this big meeting, and I'm sitting next to Dean and Bev Ash, his wife, and they show us the boundary changes. And I realize that I am being pulled out of my neighborhood, right? And to understand, so you know, our little 12 by 12 block, they took out two blocks and put it with another ward. And those two blocks had half of the ward council in it. So I've been primary president, my husband is in the bishopric, several other people gone, because those were blocks where people actually owned homes in this area. And so I'm sitting there next to her, holding hands. We're both crying, like serious crying in church. This is not sniffly, I feel the spirit stuff. This is like sobbing. And the state counselor is presenting this to us and saying, yeah, we've thought about this, and we know you will all take this in faith and know that this is good and be happy with it. And I'm like, what the hell? You haven't even let me realize what you're doing to me, and you're already telling me to be happy about it? I don't appreciate being told how to feel emotionally, ever. That emotional manipulation stuff, I mean, it works, but I don't like it. So, sitting there crying, and this is the first time where we were asked to do a sustaining vote that we would accept this, where I did not raise my hand in the square. I just couldn't do it. I was shaking and upset. And maybe if a little bit of time had passed, I could have, you know, like gotten my feet under myself and done it. But I do have to say that not sustaining at that point has made me feel outside. I don't know that that was a good thing. But what I found is that even if I didn't think the change was particularly inspired, and I was terribly worried about the ward that we were leaving, we have an amazing capacity to make something good out of crap, right? And so the narratives that we tell ourselves and how we reshape the events of our lives can strengthen us and lift us. And honestly, our neighborhood, this great little Zion that we're struggling to build together, was too inwardly turned. We were taking care of each other, but we didn't worry about the people on the other side of the street. There's another neighborhood, another concern. And so, by breaking us out, and our ward and the next ward that we got moved into, both of those wards were split down the streets that were the heart of the ward. The hearts of the wards were broken so that we could learn to love new people, so that we could look outward, so that our sense of Zion would expand. It's been 3 years since that boundary change. I'm going to wrap up. And we are learning to love outward. We are going beyond our immediate concerns of our family and our ward and expanding. And if Zion is to happen in this church, we have to go beyond just the bounds of our families and our wards and members of the church. It's not enough to save ourselves and all our dead. We have to look to the whole world, to the restoration of all things. We have to work to restore this garden state. And then we will have expanded our idea of Zion enough to be acceptable to God. Thank you.
I prefer you down here. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Okay, I'm going to talk really fast. I'm going to discard my notes. I've got 12 minutes, so here we go. How many of you have read the Mormon Worker blog? Here, anybody? Okay, what you need to do, write this down, because I'm not going to get everything in today, obviously. TheMormonWorker.wordpress.com. So what I'm going to say today isn't going to be structured, and it's going to be fast, but if you want the real goods, go to the blog, read the post, and there it is. Anyway, what I'd like you to do is imagine yourself free. Rock, do you feel free?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's totally free. Imagine a world where there is no sectarian creeds, there's no limits, and you have what? You have the words of Christ. So my thesis today is to look to Christ in the model, not look to the church. I think the truest statement that Joseph Smith ever said is there's no church that's true. Churches are only a means to an end and not the end in of itself. So what I want to talk about today is doctrinally reimagining. What we're talking about is a kingdom. The Lord said through Isaiah, he says, more are the children of the desolate than the married wife. And they shall come from north, south, and east, and west. And like Dominic Crossan has said, the most subversive message of Christ is that the family of mankind, that we're all part of the same family. So we no more boundaries, no more limitations of that sort. Also, before I forget, because I'll run out of time and forget, also I'd like you to go to bycommonconsent.org. Humor me, write it down, even if you're not going to write it down. Pretend like you are. How many of you signed the petition for full financial transparency in our church? Okay, some of you had. Look at it. Look at the little introduction that was written there. We've got like 200 signatures in the last couple weeks. It comes up every so often. There's a reason. There's a subversive reason. Now, the reasons and motivations I have, you got to understand that when you start reading my writings, I'm a radical Christian, nonviolent, of course. And I don't think the kingdom occurs by incremental changes or pleading to the church, hey, let's make this little improvement here, or let's have a fourth mission, or let's have the needle move a little bit here in the bureaucracy. It happens when we reimagine an entirely different thing and we do it entirely on our own. So, my thesis is look to Christ and that model. So let me go back to the original model. By the way, if you want to understand how radical the way I approach doctrine, look at Matthew 25. I tried that out on my high priest and they were aghast. But I'm convinced that the people that failed the test in Matthew 25 was the virgins that didn't share the oil. They really failed the test big time. And there is a way to reread it. All the clues are there. Because remember, Matthew 25 was one sermon. It wasn't just a parable here and proof texting. And the guy that was the real hero was the one that had his talent taken away because he refused to play ball. So I want to talk about early Christianity, the first 3 centuries. That has not been restored. I'm sorry. Yeah, we got word matches, apostles and priests and all that sort of thing. But it has not been restored. Okay? Because the way that they practice is much broader than that. Okay, so let me talk about the way. The early Christians were what when it came to military? What were they?
Pacifists.
They were pacifists. It's not even a close call. And if you look at the writings, and in the interest of time, I'm not going to read it. But look at my essay at LDS. Write this down too, please. LDSRenounceWar.org. LDSRenounceWar.org. After I spoke in D.C., we had all these LDS professionals there, security professionals. I made an argument of why our doctrine demands that we be conscientious objectors. I challenge you to read that essay that I wrote. This sounds really arrogant, I'm sorry, but it's bulletproof, doctrinally. I mean, there's no other way but for us to be conscientious objectors. So in early Christianity, they were pacifists. They renounced all form of violence, and it was that radical Christianity that was able to start the kingdom, which still is moving forward. So the church is only a means to an end. It's not the kingdom itself. It's either more or less effective. Right now, that corporation we have ain't too effective. So I say, you know what? Forget it. Let's move on. Let's establish Zion. We've been taught the principles. Let's move on. Now, I'm going to leave aside the social justice and the economic, and we do write about that and talk about that in the Mormon Worker, but I want to focus on war just to illustrate a point. The early Christians renounced all form of violence completely.
it was such a shock to the world how they related in the early martyrs that Christianity was able to take root. And then at the 3rd century AD, there was the Constantine Shift, and I'm sure you've heard of that, where there were no Christians, essentially no Christians that were part of the military. They didn't pledge allegiance to the state. And then overnight, when Constantine took power, just like that, there was a shift, and they began to pledge allegiance. And then, as Tolstoy said, the whole army was full of Christians. They had merged with the state, and that's exactly what we've done. You know, if I could go back in time, the Vietnam time, I'd say, hell no, we won't go. We're conscientious objectors. Where was the revelation then? Where was the DNC 98? Where was it? Where is it now? Elder Nelson gave a talk. Am I out of time?
No.
Oh, okay, I'm talking fast, sorry. Elder Nelson gave a talk, remember, of peacemakers in the fall of 2002? I was sitting there with my dad, who fought in Patton's infantry, and breaking down in tears. He says, I am certain our church will denounce this war. This is a war of aggression. I'm certain of that. This just won't happen again like Vietnam. Well, I'll be damned. You know, when he gave that talk, the PR department the next day said, hey, it doesn't apply to current hostilities. Yeah. Well, what does it apply to? So my argument is, don't look to the church. When you look at Lehi's dream, and I got this from Damon Smith, go back in the Book of Mormon. He sees a man dressed in white robes. Where is that man leading to? Do you know? Leads him to a dead end. The church is a dead end. A church is only a means to an end. Authority is a dead end. Forget it. If Mormons want to be conscientious objectors, let's be conscientious objectors. Let's join our voices together. And let's be known as conscientious objectors. And then, of course, President Hinckley gave his talk. And in my mind, we have rejected in both word and deed the peace covenant of Section 98. Now, I believe that Joseph Smith was an oracle and a seer. He had revelations. But he really screwed up. I'm sorry. There was greed in Kirtland. There was violence in Missouri when we became Danites. And then there was covetousness in Nauvoo. That's not the model to look to. The model to look to is what happened in the first 3 centuries of Christianity. That model continues today. Right now what we have is in the world what's called emergent Christianity. I don't know if you've heard of that. People from all walks of life in Christianity are getting a clue. They're emerging out of their creeds and their sects. Let me give you an example. And I know this is off the topic a little bit. Am I about done?
5 minutes.
How much? Oh, I thought it was less time. Okay, I'll slow down a little. Okay. When I was a counselor to a full-time mission president and out in the mission field, he had me interview a woman, a very remarkable woman. She was a faith healer. She was known nationally and internationally. And she had this gift of healing. It was just the most remarkable thing. And I met her with her husband, and we talked for a few hours, and she said, I've read all the Book of Mormon, the Doctrine and Covenants, I've read all these scriptures. And it was like, wow, she really gets it. You know, she understands what Zion is, the whole nine yards. And she said, well, but I have this power in my hands. When I put my hands on people, I can heal them. I don't know how it happens. I don't know if this is true or not, but she felt it. She said it was a gift that God gave me. So she, because she was a special exception, she said, a few years ago I talked to one apostle, and the apostle told me, he said, look, if you join the church and you know it's true, you won't be able to lay on hands and you won't be able to do that. Sorry, it's in the priesthood. And then she met with that apostle, and then the other apostle said, well, and I'm not going to name names, I'll tell you afterwards if you want to hear it, they're still alive. And the other one said, well, you know, if you join the church, you're going to find that that gift will probably go away because it will be within the priesthood. So she asked me, what would you do? And I said, imagine, because I'm an anarchist, imagine yourself free. How can you read the Book of Mormon and deny the gifts of God and talk in terms of giving that up? So she didn't join the church. Maybe she has sense. I don't know. I hope not. But the point is, imagine ourselves free. We don't need the church. The church is a means to an end. It's a resource. I use it as a resource. I've been involved... 3 minutes? Okay. I've been involved with the Liahona Foundation. The board of directors, I was on it at one time. Because of my radicalness, I asked to be removed because I didn't want to be tainted with that. And they said, gosh, you know, we've got this much money we've raised, and this is the good that we've been able to do over here. And if only the church would do this, we could feed all the starving children. So let's go talk to them. I said, the last thing you want to do is go talk to them. Forget it. We don't need it. We don't need the bureaucracy. We don't need the straitjacket. We can be conscientious objectors. Mormonism, you look at the DVD, Let Your Heart Not Be Troubled, Boyd K. Packer, what does he say? He says, don't be troubled. Hey, go kill the bad guys. Just like, and what he said was the exact words that Pope Urban II said to the Crusades. It's on us. Just go do it. And just be a good Christian in the process. Nonsense. We don't need their DVDs. We don't need their permission. We can be conscientious objectors, and we should be. We should be radical Christians. And until we reimagine radical Christianity and start becoming conscientious objectors to all forms of violence, and of course there's a degree of violence, there's a nuclear pacifism, all of the pure Christianity, I'm somewhere not quite there. I strive to be, but whatever. And until we reimagine that, and also with social justice, we don't need it. The Liahona Foundation doesn't need it, and it doesn't want it. We don't need boundaries. We need to reimagine. And with our imagination and faith, we need to be radical. So the next time Condi Rice comes talks at BYU, the Mormon Worker sponsored that. Were any of you there? Did you hear about it? Our protest? I guess we're not that well known. But the next time, it's going to be on our blog. And the next time that happens, dang it, show up and be a voice, and be a voice of dissent. The blogs I referred you to is a voice of dissent. And I'm telling people, at least put your signature on it and say, you know what? I'm going to see what it's like to actually exercise my voice. Don't look to authority. Don't look to the church. Look to Christ. Thank you.
Donation of
no.
Well, this has been fun to hear people's perspectives. I'm not so much interested in the doctrine as I am the practice of consecration and stewardship. I guess it's been 25 years since we had that seminar in Provo Sunstone at the
Plotting Zion
at the Marriott. Anybody here today that was there then? See, that's our problem.
Jim.
Were you there, Jim? Were you there?
Yeah.
Those were the good old days. When this was a legitimate topic, a legitimate topic to discuss in radical ways, in old Christianity ways, in Book of Mormon ways, in the Restoration Gospel ways. And we had this big vision of how we were going to change the world. And I've spent my life before and since then trying to figure out how to do that. I could sit around all day and write stuff on my blogs. I could go to church and volunteer for every calling that they needed or that was open or whatever. But I think for me, the opportunity has come to be able to sit down and pray and practice consecration and try to do it in my little neighborhood ward in Provo, where I'm surrounded by lots of Republicans, pretty militant Republicans. And sometimes they get a little shaken with what I say and what I do and the repentance I may call them to, but I just keep saying to them, look around at our society. Look at the greed of the CEOs. Look at the gaps between rich and poor that 47% of our good friend, Brother Romney, and his home teacher, Glenn Beck. I don't know when Nibley's book came out.
92.
Was it 92? And our book, Working Towards Zion. So Nibley's was approaching Zion. Jim Lucas, attorney in New York, works for a very impressive Jewish corporations. We decided, let's try to move from approaching and move from the doctrinal to the practical. How can we actually work towards Zion? And so that book came out, and it's, I don't know, 500 pages or something like that. A lot of Mormons contacted me and said it was too big, it was too thick, too complex, and this includes guys who got their PhDs in econ at Harvard and were Mitt Romney's partners and VPs of Microsoft and Apple and other places. They said it was too big and too academic. So we later came out with a little version, a couple of my friends, the Reader's Digest version. It's 120 pages. You can take that. Yeah. United for Zion. And you can find them on the web, or you can email me if you can't find them. Warner Woodworth, warner_woodworth@byu.edu. So I've been trying to figure out, so if we take these theories, and if we take these scriptures, if we take these teachings, what would life be like? And really, how do we face the problems of Mormon greed in Utah particularly, but all over the world, in, at least in the industrial societies, and how do we rebalance our theology and our religious practices given the huge and growing gap between the saints in the States and the saints around the globe, those who can't feed their kids, Maria who can't afford to send her kids to school, Jose the returned missionary who can't afford bus fare to go to church, say nothing about get married in the temple and try to raise a family or whatever. So I've been working with different groups trying to figure out how to apply some of these teachings in our own society and in the societies of the world. And I've been blessed to be able to work with a lot of amazing Latter-day Saints and a lot of amazing Catholics and Buddhists and Muslims and others. Here's just a bit of the theology that I'm trying to figure out how to practice. Here's Brigham. Zion will eventually extend over the whole earth. There will be no nuclear corner upon the earth, but what will be in Zion? It will be Zion. DNC 104. For the earth is full, and there's nothing to spare. Mahatma Gandhi, one of my other prophets and apostles. Earth provides enough to satisfy man's need, but not enough for every man's greed. So I'm seeing these ideas as a kind of theology of social entrepreneurship. Not a theology of doctrine, but of how to get out and spread the resources we have for every man's need. Here's George Q. Cannon, who was a counselor to four prophets. The growth of wealth in the hands of a few individuals threatens us with greater danger today than anything that can be done by outsiders. God does not design there should be classes among us, one class lifted above another. When I started my first NGO in the Philippines in 89, Mentors International, I talked with several of the 12 and said, I'm going to try to figure out how to apply what I'm doing in my business school classes with my MBAs at the Y and do it in the real world of poverty, of sweat, of hot temperatures, of joblessness. And I said, any advice? And they said, yeah, don't try to work with the church. Church will kill it. The bureaucracy will smother. So that was very helpful insight. But one of the comments Apostle so-and-so said was, Warner, whatever you do, don't try to build an economy in the Philippines like the one along the Wasatch Front. And he looked out at his window out there at the mountains with all the mansions by some of our leading industrialists and politicians. He was saying that's the last thing we need as a people. President McKay, the mission of the church is to transform society so the world may be a more peaceful place. Lorenzo Snow, we should employ our surplus means in a manner that poor can have employment and see before them a competence and the conveniences of life. Don't put your money into gold, he was saying. Don't invest in some high-tech industry where their profits are going to go through the roof. Use it to create jobs, simple jobs, for the masses, for the little guy, the little woman, the little man. We will take a moral view, says Brigham Young, a political view, and see the inequality that exists in the human family. It's an unequal condition of mankind. What is to be done? The Latter-day Saints will never accomplish their mission until this inequality shall cease on earth. What does that say today? We're baptizing. We're spreading the good word. We got videos galore. But inequality continues to grow within our own society, within our own state, within our country, and around the world. When I started teaching MBAs, I remember discovering this heinous practice, this terrible reality, that the average U.S. CEO was making about 16 times the compensation given to the average worker in his or her factory. And today it's 352 times. We are engulfed in Babylon, and we're apparently trying to mimic it in lots of aspects of our society. Joseph F. Smith: it was the doctrine of the prophet Joseph that a religion that has not the power to save people temporally and make them prosperous and happy here cannot be depended upon to save them spiritually, to exalt them in the life to come. And then there's Parley Pratt's: I expect the saints to give money to support the poor, and if they do not do it, their religion is vain. We preach a religion that very materially affects men's purposes, men's purses, and a religion that does not affect men's purses is worse than none. And I don't think that means we should worry so much about what the church is doing with our little 10%. That's nothing. And yeah, I'd like there to be openness about how the church gets that money and what they do with it, but I'm a lot more concerned about what you guys are doing with your money than I am the church. I figured out how to start living on 80% of my income when I was in my PhD program. And then, from there, it's continued to grow. So today, I live on 20% of my income. And I'm able to give away 80%. And until we do that, I don't think we have... maybe we have the right to ask the church to be more transparent, but I'd like everybody else to be transparent as well. All right, so, You've got lots of quotes that I'm not going to be able to share with you. I would encourage you to reread sections in the DNC that talk about Zion, that talk about consecration, that talk about stewardship, and try to figure out what little bit of additional stuff can you do besides your contributions to the church, besides your taxes to the state or the feds. What else can we do with our resources to reduce pain, to diminish human suffering, to help those poor Mormon kids through the Liahona Foundation? You know, when I first started working on this stuff, there were two NGOs that had been started in Utah in 1985. I was a part of one of them. And when we had that conference in 90, we were very happy about that, and I spoke, and then I wrote in Sunstone a few little instances of Mormons and Catholics trying to build their own little Zion. Today, that number's mushroomed. There's about 250 nonprofits based in Utah doing work to bring economic well-being to the poor around the globe. But there's so much more that needs to be done. I'd hope and pray that we can each figure out ways to practice what we preach in our own lives, in our families, and in our communities. Thanks very much.
23 minutes for us to continue the discussion. So please probably come up, at least stand up front. I'll hand you the mic if you'd like to. And push anybody. I appreciate everybody being right on their time limits. And so if you felt like you wanted to hear something more from them, feel free to. But
yes,
then Tom, then Chris.
In the old days of the church, when there were building contributions asked for, there were more opportunities for people to stretch. If you were poor, you would give a little teeny extra. If you weren't, they would sometimes hit you pretty big. And those opportunities to give for the common good, besides tithing and fast offerings, we don't have those opportunities nearly as much formalized. I've heard stories of leaders in the church who would approach people of wealth with specific needs in their wards or in their situations and ask them to contribute. And I think that is institutionally a really wonderful thing that's behind the scenes. Does anybody have experience or observation about ways that we could, within the structure of the present leadership, do more behind the scenes work to live the law that we all kind of feel like we should?
Anybody? You guys working? Yeah. A better example of that is when that wealthy member goes to the bishop and says, I got an extra 10 grand or 100 grand. How could you use that with the folks who are struggling, those that are handicapped, those that are suffering?
Do you do that or are you
doing
that?
Yeah, I do that. But I tell her, and you know where I find people practice that more than any place around? Provo or Salt Lake. It's in Brazil. It's in Mozambique. It's in Rwanda. When people take that initiative, there's nothing stopping us from living the law of consecration now. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of times the bishops don't know. They're not that aware. That's our job. I know a lot of people say, I'm just giving my, I've had thousands of fundraisers over the years. People say, I just give it to the church. Then I don't have to worry about it. I say, that's so irresponsible. You're making them make the decision. You're too lazy to read about the suffering of those kids in Fiji. You're not willing to exert yourself at all to try to really be a Christian. So it's just a sour point. Painful point for me.
Anyone else on Brent's awareness or? Thanks. Good question, Father Tom.
It's a wonderful topic that the panel has brought up today. I loved everybody's presentation. A couple of thoughts I have with a couple of questions, if you'll permit me. I've often wondered, reading LDS scripture, why the LDS church didn't end up being a pacifist church like the Brethren, the Mennonites, and others. But I've just had to kind of resolve that in my thinking. Why they didn't become a peace church was look at the environment they grew up in, in the Western movement and what led them to Utah and to Missouri to begin with. Probably would not be the same environment as the Brethren Church who grew up in Germany and the Mennonites and others who, opposed the Kaiser and the German military and other things out of the Reformation. So I think by making the kingdom ethic that I hear you talking about, that comes from Zion and leads the people to Zion, more apparent, as Hugh Nibley wrote about from Isaiah 47, battle and contrast, is probably the ethic we need. One of the questions I have for coming from the general Christian church is, we look at consecration as something that is done for a priestly ordination, for a priest or especially a bishop. Would it help if the LDS Church also rephrased this and went back to the sanctus argument or sanctification that Christianity has held to for centuries, that we are set apart to do a work, and as John 14, 15, and 16 in the high priestly prayer say, that's where our priesthood is found, in the works that we do, and could the LDS Church help the rest of us understand the consecrated life and what that is supposed to be, what Hugh Nibley was reacting to? Because as I listen to it, sermons for thousands of years have been preached about sanctification, and would it help the saints if that were the presentation, to be set apart to do these holy things?
Let me take this back.
Please.
I'm going to approach that a little bit different, Tom. This is radical. The church is redeemable.
if you believe the Book of Mormon is true, and I do, I don't care if it's historical or not. That's relevant to me.
Sure.
The Book of Mormon is subversive to the Gentile church that we created. It's not redeemable. We're not going to fix it. And in reference to pacifism or peace things, we have to become it. I don't think we're flying. Well, I don't care what the church does anymore. In reference to that topic, we're on our own. One other thing, while I've got in mind, people might ask, why do I want transparency? I believe that the church doctrine demands transparency by voice of common consent. The reason I want transparency is I actually want the saints to own that 10% again. When I mean own it, I told my bishop I'm a full taxpayer. I don't pay anything to the trademark or the corporation of the president. I don't. Oh, I pay a nominal amount. But I don't need to know where it goes because I know where it goes. It goes to the lease. So my conscience is totally free on that topic. So I guess I'm pulling away more from more what the church defines or how they're going to move it doctrinally. Whatever. You know what? It's irredeemable. It's almost like a brother got together and said, you know what? I know what we need to do. The Book of Mormon is under assault. It's historical anachronisms. Let's at least make it prophetically true. Let's build City Creek. Let's build this. Let's do that. And let's show that it's at least prophetic, for heaven's sakes.
One other thing with ecclesiology that I'd like to respond to you with, and maybe it'll help all the saints here. We can look at it nominal Christianity. We are the church. It's the spirit of the saints. Yeah. Is who the church is, not necessarily just corporate structure.
Yeah, it's not fixable.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Okay.
Did anyone else have anything on Tom's question about like elevating the consecrated life?
We only got a couple more minutes, right?
How long it's the 30 after. So Boyd, looked like you had something. But maybe these three will be about the only questions we'll get today.
I'm one of those optimists. I really do think the church has its work, and I think it's a work that's called to produce. And the fact that it's not doing it yet, I mean, we can blame the leadership, but the problem with that is the Mormon church, we are the leadership. And, you know, Hugh Dibley never held any office in the church. When I was working on the biography, and I was asking this question, did he have any impact on the church? Regards to consecration. And in terms of the institutional church, I tend to agree with you, Ron, I don't think he did. But in terms of individual lives, I got letter after letter from people who had changed their lives, who had felt this call to move in a different direction. People who had given up jobs and were now, I joke sometimes that Q will be ruining more lives than
I did they feel that way?
No, they were very happy. Law degrees and you know, big corporations,
according to their parents.
And you know, powerful things with their lives, but making a much more meager salary. And so I think in a church where we are the church, we do have a call. And, you know, I applaud Warner because I don't have that kind of integrity. I you know, have my midlife crisis in biology. So I really, you know, I feel this stinging rebuke.
That's what I wanted.
Thank you. Chris? Chris Bradford here.
Just a couple of really short questions, and you can kind of take your pick. First off, with the topic being sort of contemporary awareness in the church of the concept of Zion, I wonder if any of you have read Joseph Spencer's recent book, For Zion, and if you have, whether you have a reaction to it. And then the other two quick questions would be, what do you see as the roles of education and technology in building Zion?
I know Jim
read Joe's book recently.
Well, and I don't feel capable to really respond. Although he does, one of the really interesting things is he draws kind of a parallel between the notion of consecration and the Christian monastics, and draws some language. And that I thought of that in relation to Father Tom's question about that sort of monastic connection. I also, just last week, when you asked the question about education, just a quick response, I read an article by Paul Mason of The Guardian,
he's an economist, and he talks about this huge coming transformation in world economics, and he thinks that will revolve around information and the free access to information. And honestly, I don't, since I don't understand some of the economic concepts, but there are people who really see that as something that's going to radically change our world, and where material property is not going to be the real currency. It's going to be information and education that's going to be. So he has a book coming out soon if you want to listen, if you want to try to figure it out.
That goes to the next question. Education and technology.
Right. Yes. He was moving into that. Yeah. So either response to Joe's book or education or technology as you see it. Chris, did you mostly think it within the church context or just the world?
The world.
Any thoughts from any other ones?
We're going to move towards Star Trek. Star Trek, the socialists, obviously. You know, that's what technology will do. Yeah.
Talking about
anyway,
that's what I'm talking. Technology will.
Technology, yeah. Technology. Of course, that could be the transhumanist more than technology.
Which is Chris.
Yeah, we know. I agree, yeah.
Did anyone have a thought?
We imagine the world. Yeah.
Anybody else
watch Star Trek? Well, I was asked to do the gospel doctrine lesson just before New Year's Eve, and the lesson was on the last days. And I thought, what a great topic to be in the year talking about the doom and gloom of the last days. but I came across a wonderful chart. Cameron put this together. This 26 charts and maps that show the world is getting much, much better. And I mean, it talks about economic progress, extreme poverty, hunger,
literacy,
child labor. Yeah, I mean, it's the world is getting better. And so I think one of the problems with that pessimistic kind of attitude that we often see reflected in that kind of millennialist part that we have retained is that we focus on all the bad stuff, and it's so depressing, and everybody gets overwhelmed by, you know, it's just like, please, Christ, come and fix this, but we never take responsibility for what we need. So, and I think technology does democratize things and has made a difference, and it can. I think it also can be used for evil, but I think it is a changing world.
Yeah. If we even think of getting educated, like what John Crosson was talking about, to basically see what was the true message of Jesus Christ and how we're off it. That's education too. We're not thinking of it that way, but just right there, that critique, in our, if it got worked into Sunday school, is just powerful. So great, please.
So I couldn't decide whether to come here or to the social justice panel upstairs, so I was kind of running back and forth. I don't know if someone coming in the back. But what I heard up there that I didn't hear as much of down here, and I'm glad I heard this down here, was that the role of Christ asking us to be more charitable and all these things, down here the discussion was more about individual people working together and building community that way. Upstairs it was more about petitioning governments, and that kind of stuff sounds scary to me, because from the government perspective, it seems to me like you've got to do that governments do a lot of harm to do a little bit of good, whereas individual people working together can do mostly just good if they're all freely doing it. So does anybody see any role for government in any of this, or is it as I see it, which is just stay out of the way, kind of?
Just a thought. Well, I can't say anything about the role of government because I have the same apprehension that you have. And in the early days of the church, when Dan and I talked about this before, I kind of have the same feeling about the role of the church in consecration and stewardship. Like, I don't know how much I would trust my bishop to divvy up resources fairly. But a thought just crossed my mind as you were talking about that, and as Warner brought up, and that the number of things going on in the world today to try, on people's own initiative, to try to be helpful and useful things is astonishing. Paul Hawken wrote a book a few years ago, and I'm blanking on the name of it, but he tried to outline, and his argument was that the number of NGOs and private organizations in the world right now far out-trump the governments in the good that they do and the initiatives that they take. and nobody counts it up, and no one even sees it as part of the landscape, because each one by itself is so small and insignificant. But taken as a whole, he argues that that's a huge, huge movement going on right now.
What was that?
And I think that's largely responsible for some of the things that Boyd talked about, all of these things going up, education and medical access and things like
what
that.
What was that?
It's Paul Hawking, and I've seen another cover.
It's like it's called like Sacred Quest or something.
Something like that, yeah. You should Google Paul Hawking and you'll find it.
Yeah.
There's three or four of his books.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, I'm all for government, and I'm all for NGOs and the social sector, the civil sector, third sector. It's a huge movement, and the church is funding a ton of that kind of stuff around the globe because they're seeing there's stuff they can't do institutionally. The church can't do it, or it's too risky for them to be a part of it because, you know, who knows where it might lead. But they're giving money under the table or above the table. And sometimes it's a PR people taking a photo op, you know, for the church news. A lot of their stuff you don't know about. And it's they're giving money to lots of socialist organizations, just in case you were wondering about that. for me, the government's role has been huge in a couple of movements related to this dying stuff and consecration and equality. They're called co-ops, worker co-ops. They're called ESOPs, employee stock ownership plans. When Chris Meek, my dear colleague, and I testified in Congress about the need to create a more equal society, those guys in Congress, in the Senate, and the House said, yeah, we should, if we're truly going to be a capitalist society, more people have to have access to capital. So we started getting support for these ESOP laws where now the employees own the business. And in many cases, they're radically democratic. They elect managers, they elect the board, they decide how to distribute profits at the end of the year. And that's just in our own state, in our own Western U.S. as well as across the country. It's huge around the globe. And governments can play a critical role in providing tax incentives and giving tax breaks to ESOPs, where unions and workers and community leaders together decide to save that plant that's going under, that factory that's going bankrupt, and resurrect it, and they become hugely successful. And then those workers retiring, not just with their union pension, but with their shares of stock. A lot of companies across this land now, but when those employees retire, they're retiring with $1 million worth of stock that the company's getting them at the end so they can keep the ownership within the existing employees. So it's a huge movement, and I think there's many, many important contributions. All three, the church, the businesses, all four, I guess, the NGOs, and the government.
Anyone else? Chris, with the last 4 minutes.
All right.
What'd you start?
I actually have a question for Sister Whipple, actually from Jeffers as well, so I'll just quote the end of his poem, Rearmament, all right? I would burn my right hand in a slow fire to change the future. I should do so foolishly. The beauty of modern man is not in the persons, but in the disastrous rhythm, the heavy and mobile masses, the dance of the dream-led masses down the dark mountain. And he's obviously writing about World War II, but what happens when these systems that are producing the problems, because I see global problems as largely systemic, what happens when anything you could ever conceive of doing seems insignificant? And that ties into Jeffers' aesthetic as well. So how do you respond to that?
I like Jeffers' response to that. He was like a Jeremiah, right? A prophet out there on the California coast, decrying our greed and wars and things like that. And he was not the most social of people. So you know, he was there and he worked with his hands and stone to build his house and his tower, and he wrote his poetry. Sometimes you have to retreat to what you personally can do, what you can build. And I think, you know, we do need to work on these larger scales, right? Within our communities, we need to petition for a government. But sometimes that feels very hopeless. But because we have a doctrine of choice and accountability that works on a personal level, we know that we each individually need to keep doing what we can. And there's hope in that, and there's some redemption in that, even if we can't change the world. And that's where I find hope in Jeffers and also in working on hopeless causes.
Can I add one?
Yeah.
I agree with that completely. You have to do what you want. But I actually believe that the transhumanist left, I actually believe we have to change systemically. Something has to happen fundamentally. I actually think optimistically that we're actually moving into the millennium right now. We have to walk out of our creed. We have to take the values and the doctrines we have and move and create a larger kingdom and community. But I actually think, like the military-industrial complex, as a transhumanist and speaking in those terms, that's one thing that can destroy the whole thing. We can do our home teaching better. We can be kind to our neighbors and take cookies. But there are forces out there that will destroy the entire Earth. And the scariest thing to me are fundamentalists, whether it's fundamentalist Mormons or fundamentalist Islam, whatever. What Obama did with Iran, I think, is brilliant. You know, there are email exchanges going down between Iran and Israelis. We, the people, need to take control of this, and it needs to be done systemically. And we need to become a voice for that. We have to go beyond that and talk to governments, and sometimes defy governments. It can happen. It doesn't take a lot. It doesn't take a majority to do it. It just takes enough voices to do it to change the system.
Hey, good timing. Thank you, you guys. Everybody wrote down websites from Ron, right? Got a few book titles. We see examples of people who really are animated by this, and I know that all of us, we got something in our hearts now from this 90 minutes together, and I'm grateful for that, and ask you to thank the whole panel. Thanks.